I already was a historian. That is, I had gone through all the professional training of a historian. I had a PhD from Columbia University, and I had never encountered in any of my classes anywhere as an undergraduate or graduate the name of Emma Goldman. Now, that tells you something about historical education in this country. I know everybody complains about historical education, but people complain about it from different points of view. You know, the New York Times, I remember a few years ago, complained about the historical ignorance of students because they didn't know who was the president during the Mexican War, you know, and didn't know whether the Homestead Act came before the Civil Service Act, you know, and things like that. But, you know, there's another point of view in which people are distressed because our historical education doesn't include people like Emma Goldman or Big Bill Haywood, or only tells about Helen Keller as a sort of a struggling person who overcame handicaps and doesn't tell about her as a socialist and an anti-war, anti-militarist person. So in the 1960s, actually I must say, reading outside of my formal education, because sometimes you read outside of your classes, which is when you learn the most. And then, and I had come across a book called Critics and Crusaders, which some of you, you know, three of you may know. And Critics and Crusaders, wonderful book. Get it in a library, but it has chapters on a lot of people that never appear in history books, but are some of the great people of American history. And there I had read a chapter on Emma Goldman, but then put it somewhere in the back of my mind. Then in the 1960s, I went to some conference in Pennsylvania on violence, and there encountered another historian, and historians ask one another, just to let you in on how historians speak to one another, what have you done? You know, what have you written? Which means, what have you written? This was Richard Drinnen I ran into, and he said, I've written this biography of Emma Goldman. So after the conference, I went to get the biography, because you always want to read books by people that you've met. So when somebody catches you reading it, you say, I know this person. I read this really wonderful biography of Emma Goldman, Living My Life. No, I'm sorry, Rebel in Paradise. Rebel in Paradise by Richard Drinnen, which still remains as one of the, you know, really fine biography, and was a pioneering thing since most of the work on and by Emma Goldman had been out of print for some time. That led me to Living My Life. And for those of you who haven't read her autobiography, Living My Life, you should immediately go and read it. As big as it is, it will read very fast because it's so interesting. And I even, undaunted by the size of the book, you know, two volumes, or you can sometimes get a very fat one-volume edition, but undaunted by the size of the book, I even several years had some of my assigned it to my students to read, and it turned out to be one of the all-time hit books for my students to read. I think there were three books of all the books I assigned my students to read over the decades. There were three books that were by far the most popular, and one of them was Living My Life by Emma Goldman. The other was the autobiography of Malcolm X. And the third was Dalton Trumbo's novel, Johnny Got His Gun. You can see those aren't traditional text material. But Emma Goldman was not being taught, and so I decided my students had to know something about anarchism and about Emma Goldman and her friends. And when I started to teach at Boston University, I attended one of those, they, when you start to teach somewhere, they have a reception for new faculty members, which is always very boring. And at this reception for new faculty members, I found myself sipping sherry with another new faculty member who was going to be in, well, what questions you ask? What department will you be in? He's going to be in the philosophy department. What department will I be in? Well, I was going to be in the political science department. Ah. Oh. And what is your political philosophy, he asked. Well, you're not supposed to ask that of somebody in the political science department. I never heard of anybody in the political science department who had a political philosophy, you see. It's not professional. But I thought I had to come up with something, so I said, I guess I'm an anarchist. And he looked at me, and he said, that's impossible. Anyway, so anarchism is still not taught. It's interesting. I teach political theory, political philosophy, also long lists of political theorists and anarchists, and anarchism, you know, still doesn't have a recognition as a political philosophy. So it's an important thing for people to look at and for people to read. From Living My Life, from Emma Goldman's autobiography, I went on to Alexander Berkman's Prison Memoirs of an Anarchist, which has been out of print for a long time, but there's a new sort of edition which has most of it and other Berkman's writings, which is published by a little publishing outfit in Manhattan called Four Walls, Eight Windows. And then what? Oh, and then I was in Amsterdam. And because I was in Amsterdam, I decided to look up the International Institute of Social History, which if you ever go to Amsterdam, and I'm sure all of you will soon go to Amsterdam, you will find in the International Institute of Social History a wonderful collection of documents, materials, letters from and to all sorts of people. And you know, they collected stuff from the Nazi archives. That doesn't mean the Nazi, that is from Germany, which the Nazis had secreted away and didn't want anybody to look at, you know, like Karl Marx's early letters. There was no point really secreting them away because nobody could ever read Marx's handwriting. But they had stuff, and then they had this collection of Emma Goldman, of letters to and from Emma Goldman. A wonderful collection. So I spent days and days and days sitting there in Amsterdam copying pieces of these letters. And then I get home and I find that Richard Drennan has already done that and has published a lot of that. He and his wife, Anna Marie Drennan, published that in a book, which also you should read. I'm telling you all of this, I'm giving you this bibliographical information because I can't, there's not much I can tell you in a short time about the fantastically rich and complex life. And so, you know, you really have to go and read stuff for yourself. But they publish a book called Nowhere at Home, which are the letters that Emma Goldman and Alexander Berkman wrote to one another in exile after, you know, they been deported from the United States. Among those letters that I read at the International Institute of Social History were the letters from Ben Reitman. And as I read them, I'd never come across that before, and as I read those letters, I thought that the International Institute of Social History would be ablaze in 5 minutes from those letters. Well, you have to read those letters. I mean, you can't even call them love letters. I mean, the phrase love letter is a pallid description of the letters that went between Reitman and Goldman. You'll find some of them reproduced in Candace Falk's book. I've been talking to you about the older literature, but in the last 2 years there have been a number of books. One of them, Candace Falk's books, Love, Anarchy, and Emma Goldman, and she reproduces what's called Love and Anarchy, I think. She reproduces some of the Reitman Goldman letters. And, what I think I'll do is sort of give you, I'm looking at you and trying to figure out, by looking at you, how much do you know about Emma Goldman? And it's very hard to tell. So I will give you a quick rundown of her life. I don't see how I can, but I will give you a sort of quick summary of her life, and then go into what I think, talk about some of her ideas, which to me is most important. That is, her life is, of course, fascinating, and history is interesting, but I've never been a historian who sort of went into the past and got lost in it, which is a common thing. Because it's so interesting. You go in, and you get lost. You don't want to come out. It's fascinating. But I believe that, I always believed you should go in, and as tempting as it is to stay, come out, and bring some of that stuff with you and apply it to what's going on today and make some connection between what has happened in the past and what is going on today. So, in that sense, her ideas, transcend the period in which she lived and connect, I think, very closely and very importantly with the kind of things that are still going on today. But she was born in Lithuania, a little town in Lithuania, which is then part of Russia, Kovno, and she grew up in poor circumstances in a Jewish family, and worked in factories at an early age, and spent some time in Königsberg with an aunt, and some time in St. Petersburg, and had sort of exhilarating experiences of going to the opera for the first time, and being excited by the music, and then she was about 16 when the family emigrated to the United States and moved to Rochester, New York. And there in Rochester, this little immigrant Jewish family lived the way immigrants without much money lived. And Emma worked in a factory, and she, at an early age, she married some guy. That's the way to put it. It was some guy that she married, and which, didn't work out very quickly, and while she was there in Rochester, she began to make sort of emotional contact with the things that were swirling around in the United States. You have to understand that this is a time, in the 1880s, the mid 1880s, this is the time when class conflict in the United States is at a very intense point. Now, that period roughly between 1877 and 1914, the period of, which is described in the history books as the period of the Industrial Revolution, the period when the United States became a great industrial power, and it's described as a period, it's described exultantly as that time when the United States became this powerful economic force. But it wasn't an exultant time for the people who worked down in the depths of that Industrial Revolution, and the people who worked in Carnegie steel mills or Rockefeller's oil fields, or worked on the railroads and who died by the thousands in building a transcontinental railroad, or the girls who went to work in the textile mills and died at the age of 25. and it was a period when all of that was crystallizing in battle for the 8-hour day and battle for lunch hours, battle for against kids working at the age of 8 and 9 and 10. I mean, here's a sort of a typical news item from that day. Sometimes I find things when I'm looking for them. But this is Trenton, New Jersey. 300 girl strikers of the American Cigar Company. They stopped work went on strike because they wanted an hour for lunch. They were working 14 hours a day, and they thought that instead of having a half hour for lunch, they should have an hour for lunch. So 3,000 girl strikers, as they put it, and they were girls, they were young, attacked the factory, the American Cigar Company, with stones and sticks, smashed the windows, demand a full hour. They're led by a 16-year-old girl named Sally Carr. Another headline from that era, millionaires living in fear and trembling. Jay Gould, some of you have heard of Jay Gould. How can I describe him? Well, for those three of you who don't know, we always hope there are three people in the audience who don't know what we're talking about. The Haymarket Affair came out of the struggle for the 8-hour day, and there was a strike at the International Harvester plant in Chicago, and the police attacked the strikers and killed a number of strikers, not an uncommon occurrence in those days, and the anarchist movement of Chicago, and it was a strong anarchist movement of Chicago. Well, as you know, it's the radicals who take the first steps, the anarchists, the Trotskyists, the communists, the socialists, you know, they're always first, you know. And the anarchists, you know, call a meeting, or mass rally, protest, the rally takes place in Chicago, not quite at Haymarket Square, but near it, but it becomes known as Haymarket Affair. And while the rally is going on and somebody is speaking from the platform, one of the anarchist leaders of Chicago, in fact, is speaking from the platform, it's a peaceful meeting. It's attacked by the police. The police charge into the meeting with their clubs flailing, and then a bomb explodes in the middle of the police, and a bunch of policemen are killed. Nobody knows who threw the bomb. Nobody to this day knows. You know, they're still, you know, one of those things that they're always trying to puzzle. That's no problem for the police if there's no evidence on who threw the bomb. What do? You arrest the 8 leading anarchists in Chicago because they must be behind it, whoever threw the bomb. And this is a common logic for arresting radicals. Something took place. Here are the radicals. The radicals must be behind it. So they arrest the 8 leading radicals and put them on trial for conspiracy to murder, and they are sentenced to death. And rouses an international cry and defense all over the country. And the George Bernard Shaw sends a cable from England saying, because the matter is now up before the Illinois Supreme Court, and the Illinois Supreme Court turns down the plea of the 8 anarchists, and George Bernard Shaw sends us telegram. He says, if America must lose 8 of its population, it could better afford to lose the 8 members of the Illinois Supreme Court than the 8 anarchists who are sentenced to death. But anyway, 4 of them were executed, and their execution had one of those effects, one of those cataclysmic effects that certain events in American history have on the consciousness of young people growing up in the society. Things like the, you know, the execution of Sacco and Vanzetti, or the execution of the Rosenbergs, and the execution of the four leaders of anarchist leaders had that kind of effect on Emma Goldman. And in 1892, when there was a strike at Homestead, Pennsylvania, a steel plant belonging to Andrew Carnegie, and the Carnegie Corporation and Henry Clay Frick managing it, called out the Pinkerton Detective Agency to break the strike, and the Pinkertons moved into the area, and there was a gun battle, and a number of the strikers were killed, and then Emma Goldman and Alexander Berkman and a few of their friends getting together in Worcester in the ice cream parlor, which they now owned. Anarchists were always figuring out ways to make money. Not a lot of money, just a little money, just survival money, just enough money to put out a magazine, enough money to maybe to escape the factory and so on. So this ice cream store in Worcester was one of their things, and so they heard about what had happened in Homestead, Pennsylvania, and decided we have to do something now, which, they do it in Europe. They assassinate czars and chiefs of police and people who symbolize the terror regimes, and now we're going to do this in the United States. We're going to kill Henry Clay Frick. They were 20, 21 years old. And Berkman sets out to do this, and they get him a suit. Because you can't, you know, when you kill somebody, you can't look bad. They get him a new suit, and they get him a gun, and a train ticket to Pittsburgh, and he gets into Henry Clay Frick's office. He was a very good anarchist, a very poor assassin, and he fired away and missed, anyway, he was then sort of knocked unconscious and then put on trial and sentenced to 22 years in prison for attempted murder. As usual, people usually jailed for attempted murder did not get 22 years in prison, but an anarchist who is, and this is still the case today, that is, political criminals who have committed the same acts that other people have committed who are not political people, the political criminals will get sentences twice or three times as big. Just that's the way the system works. And so Berkman goes to prison, actually spends 14 years in prison. During this period, Emma Goldman becomes a speaker, a leader, a strike leader. I didn't say anything about her relationship with Johann Most, who is an anarchist leader from Germany, who was a very important figure in the anarchist movement, and who's kind of helped her as she began to go out and speak and develop her abilities. But she was way beyond him in certain ways very, very soon. But she... as I say, she began to speak, very soon, this was 1893, the country's in economic crisis in 1893, huge numbers of people unemployed. Emma addresses a great meeting in Union Square, urges people who don't have food for their kids to go into the stores and take it. Another form of direct action. And anarchists, I mean, it's part of the anarchist philosophy. If people are starving, you don't write a letter to your congressman asking that legislation be introduced so that someday people may have enough food. The idea of direct action is that if people don't have enough food, you take it. Laws or no laws. You do what is necessary immediately and directly to give people what they deserve and what they need. You can't let children starve awaiting for the election of the next president. This was that philosophy. She was arrested for that, sentenced to jail, spent a year in jail on Blackwell's Island. While she was on Blackwell's Island, she encountered a prison nurse who taught her something about nursing. After she came out, she went to Europe, studied to be a midwife. And there in Europe also she met anarchist leaders, met Kropotkin, the grand old man of anarchism, and met Malatesta, the Italian anarchist, and met Louise Michel, the heroine of the 1871 Paris Commune. And her life was filled with, you know, encounters with these remarkable people who affected her and were always affected by her. And she came back to the United States and continued to speak out wherever she could, spoke on birth control. Well, that was a dangerous thing to do. And the police followed her everywhere, and she was arrested again and again. And these detectives and plainclothes people went everywhere she spoke. And one time, however, they failed to arrest her after a speech on birth control because she had spoken to, in the sort of Lower East Side of New York, to a group of Jewish women. And the detective who attended the meeting sent a report back to superiors saying that he didn't have enough evidence to arrest her because she spoke to them in Yiddish. And he wasn't that well equipped. There weren't a lot of Jewish detectives, as you might imagine. In 1901, she became really notorious because that was the year that President McKinley was assassinated. And assassinated by a man named Leon Czolgosz, who was, I don't know how to describe him. He was a marginal person, a person like a lot of the people who commit assassinations. And a person who had sometimes hung around anarchist meetings. And apparently in some of the interrogations of the police had uttered the name of Emma Goldman. Immediately a hunt on for Emma Goldman. She must be behind the assassination. She went into hiding, but finally they got her and arrested her. Didn't keep her very long because there's really no evidence against her. Sometimes it doesn't stop the police, but this time there was really nothing, and so she was released. Czolgosz was executed. His head was severed from his body so that they could examine his brain to see what it was in his brain that caused him to assassinate McKinley. Emma Goldman said they should examine the conditions of American society to see what it was. Because the conditions of American society were enough to cause anybody to become an assassin, even though she didn't believe in assassination. She did not believe that Czolgosz had done the right thing. She didn't, although she had been involved in the attempt to assassinate Frick, she did not really believe anymore in that assassination was a tactic, a proper tactic for a revolutionary movement. However, and in this she got into some conflict with her fellow anarchists who rushed to disavow Czolgosz, you know, this crazy guy who did this violent thing, and we don't want to be associated with that. They already think all anarchists are assassins and bomb throwers. We don't want to have anything to do with this guy. And Emma Goldman said, no. She said, we'd Sure, I'm opposed to his act. It was wrong. It was a stupid thing to do. But I'm not going to try to separate myself from him. And I'm going to try to point out to people what it was that led him to do this. I'm going to emphasize that. She was always that way. I mean, independent in her thinking, and always thinking in a very feeling way about people who did desperate things and things that she very often deprecated, but the causes of which she thought should be understood. Berkman came out of prison in 1906 after those 14 years, and it was a very, very emotional reunion with him and his anarchist friends. And he and Emma Goldman were no longer lovers after this, but they remained friends for the rest of their lives. In fact, one of the most remarkable examples of a long and intense friendship, real friendship between a man and a woman, even without a sexual encounter. And in fact, 2 years after Berkman came out, she and Berkman were involved in publishing an anarchist magazine, Mother Earth. And 2 years after that, she met Ben Reitman. How many of you know about her relationship with Ben Reitman? 10 people. Well, finally, I have a chance. Ben Reitman. She was doing a lecture in Chicago. She was going all around the country lecturing. And she was going to lecture in Chicago. And as usual, the police were not letting her speak and were closing meeting halls. And she was a notorious, outrageous woman, speaking about birth control, speaking about free love, saying that marriage and love had nothing in common. That marriage was an insurance contract. Marriage was an economic arrangement. Love was something else, you see. And even in 1993, there are people who would be outraged by this, right? Family values and all of that, you see. But imagine, in the early 1900s, speaking sometimes in churches about free love. Minister did not know what he was getting into. I don't know why. Or maybe he did. Didn't last long as a minister, probably, after that. But so she's speaking in Chicago, but they're closing the halls to her. And see if I can. The Chicago Tribune reports how the police, when she starts to speak, drag her off the stage. This was a very common thing with her. She was constantly being dragged off the stage by the police. After being warned that she must not speak, she goes ahead and speaks, and they drag her off the stage and arrest her. And this reporter records this conversation, the police captain. "Thought you'd come here and make trouble, eh?" said the captain. "Behave yourself," Emma shot back. "Talk like a man, even if you are a policeman." The police chief, "You can't talk here." "I'll talk when I damn please." Anyway, tells you something about her, the kind of person she is, right? Not exactly a shy and retiring person.